This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, you'll learn about the Central Coast Queer Archive Project.
And this is where we see history and recollection and memory can lead to action and advocacy.
Also, we'll hear from Wendy Lewis of the El Camino Homeless Coalition.
The last point in time count, 74% of the people counted in our county as unhoused were born and raised here.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 7th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Most of California is experiencing extreme drought right now. That means there's the possibility of bigger, more destructive wildfires earlier this summer. Cap Radio's Scott Rodd has this report from Butte County.
Taco salad, please. Chile verde.
Lunchtime brings a crew of laborers to this taco stand in Oroville. They're taking a break from clearing trees and brush around nearby homes. One of them tells Sissy Savoy about free and reduced cost programs to remove hazardous vegetation in fire-prone areas. She leaves with a box of tacos and the company's contact info. Savoy is living in a tent on her best friend's property and plans to help him rebuild after his home burned last year.
He barely got out, you know, with not even a shirt on his back, and his dog, like, had to drive through a wall of fire to get out.
The region has seen bigger and bigger fires in recent years. The Wall Fire, 6,000 acres, the Camp Fire, 150,000 acres, and the North Complex Fire last year, over 300,000 acres. But Savoy, like many of her neighbors, is committed to this place.
I was sitting up outside of my tent the other night looking at the trees. A lot of people go up there and think it's really ugly, you know, so I'm scarred, damaged. Maybe I relate to that. My own scars and damage, and I was fortunate enough to have a lot of people love me back to health.
She says she is a little nervous about this year, and for good reason. The last 18 months were among the driest and hottest on record in California. Moisture levels in fire fuels like grass and brush are below average, and the meager snowpack has largely soaked into the ground instead of flowing into lakes and rivers. Look no further than Lake Oroville to see the drought's impact.
On this side, they made some new boat ramps and kind of get a view of the lake.
Eric Eastman visits here often. He owns a houseboat and is giving me a tour of the lake in his pontoon. The marina had to remove about 70 houseboats this year because they could have run aground as the water continues to drop. Eastman's boat was spared, but he says it has an impact on the whole community.
I'd be devastated that we wouldn't be able to have our home on the water. We would still come here, and many of the owners potluck every night and get together, and so we have friends' boats that we could stay on, but it's not like staying on your boat.
The shoreline's steep, dry embankments loom over us. Lake Oroville's water is less than half of what it usually is for this time of year, and it will only continue to drop. We ride past a hillside torched by last year's North Complex fire, which sent a blizzard of embers onto the lake.
You couldn't even see one boat to the next, so thick of smoke, and they finally let people come off and blow the ash and everything off your boats, because there were huge leaves and pine needles everywhere that I just can't believe the boats didn't catch on fire.
Back on dry land, I meet up with Cal Fire Captain Robert Foxworthy. We hike along a wooded trail where much of the grass is already dried out and yellow, prime for catching fire. So what is Cal Fire doing to prepare?
We're hiring over 1,200 additional firefighters that are going to go mainly to hand crews. Until they're actually out there fighting fire and doing fire suppression, they're going to be doing fuel reduction projects.
Governor Gavin Newsom announced over $500 million in early budget spending to expand vegetation management projects. And he's proposing over $5 billion to address the drought. Foxworthy offers this plea to the public. Now is the time to pack your go bags with essential belongings and documents, and to make sure the space around your home is clear of dangerous fire fuels. In Butte County, I'm Scott Rodd.
Pride Month is celebrated in June, originally to commemorate the Stonewall Riots, which occurred at the end of June in 1969. The Central Coast Queer Archive Project collects oral and video histories of the local LGBTQ community to preserve them in a historical archive. It presents local stories of the formal and the informal spaces the LGBTQ community occupied over the last 50 years. KCBX's Daytona Clark spoke with Central Coast Queer Archive Project co-director David Weissman about the current state of the project.
Well, the project itself now has moved from just being an oral history to a video history. And part of that, too, is in thanks to the California Humanities, because we were grateful and fortunate to receive a California Humanities for All Quick Grant Award. That's been a big help in letting us technologically move ahead to make this an internet-based project that will record interviews with the senior members of the San Luis LGBTQ community. The interviews will be transcribed, and then the videos in their entirety will be posted on the website to create this historical database of what the LGBTQ movement has hopefully been like and represented over, I say, the past half century or so in this county.
What are some of the latest stories you've been able to add to the archive?
One of the clips and one of our participants is Carol Leslie. Carol Leslie has been in the county for 30 years. She is the owner of the Volumes of Pleasure bookstore in Los Osos. She's going to tell in rather heartwarming fashion about when the AIDS quilt came to visit San Luis Obispo in the early 1990s. One of our other interview participants, Kelly Quiroz, he was one of the early presidents of the Gay Student Union at Cal Poly going back to the early 1980s. And he's going to discuss some of the outreach they did at Poly Royal, and which was very pioneering as a gay organization back in those days.
Are there any specific stories you're especially excited for people to learn about through Slow Pride?
Well, I know certainly for sure. The clip involving what was the restaurant bar Breezes attracts a lot of attention. When we showed that clip to a group of the youth who were planning a Pride demonstration a few years ago, and we showed them the clip, the oohs and ahs in the audience and the sort of surprise as they watched the clip, and the clip is filled with photos from the photo album of the day. And they realized that the people at that bar don't look all that different from them. And around the room, after the clip ended, the buzz was, why don't we have a place like that in San Luis today? Why isn't there a gay bar in San Luis Obispo? And this is where we see history and recollection and memory can lead to action and advocacy.
With that, what else do you hope people can get out of exploring the stories of the Queer Archive?
We feel that's an important part of the project, is to create an intergenerational alliance between the youth and the queer elders. And it's sometimes an electronic divide, but sometimes it's a cultural divide. Part of it, too, is that an entire generation of gay men were lost to AIDS between the 1980s and the turn of the new century. And so there's missing that ability for mentorship. Another important thing is we're hoping people who tune in are engaged to the point where other senior members of the community might say, hey, I've got some stories too. Would you like to interview me? Because we have space open. There are slots available for other folks in the community with stories and history and scrapbooks and photos that they might like to share at the project. So in some ways, we're almost putting this out too as an open call to find folks who, after seeing what we're doing and who we're working with, might decide to contact us and possibly participate and become one of our future interviews.
That was the Central Coast Queer Archive Project co-director David Weissman speaking with KCBX's Daytona Clark. The Environmental Protection Agency has awarded the Santa Barbara City College Foundation a sizable grant for a project that will connect students and residents to a network of edible gardens and foster a connection to local ecosystems. KCBX's Beth Thornton has more.
The Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, has funded environmental education projects nationwide since 1992. The Santa Barbara City College Foundation, in partnership with Explore Ecology, was granted almost $100,000 for a project that will introduce students and residents to food-producing gardens and raise awareness about the local environment. SBCC Foundation Grant Director Rachel Johnson submitted the proposal for the Collaborative Community Project.
This is the largest EPA environmental education grant that's ever been awarded in Santa Barbara County.
Johnson says the goal is to reach K through 14 students and also the broader community. Along with school programs, there will be a speaker series and learning opportunities open to the public.
The main goal of the EPA for this program is to create community members who are better informed so that they themselves make better environmental decisions.
In addition to SBCC and Explore Ecology, Mesa Harmony Garden, El Centro Community Center, Westside Boys and Girls Club, Youth Drought Project, and the Botanic Garden are included in the plan. Santa Barbara City College has gardens on campus. The gardens serve as outdoor classrooms for students studying horticulture, landscaping, and the environment. And the food grown there supports the student food pantry. Dr. Adam Green teaches biology and environmental science at City College. He says the EPA-funded project will create a network of local organizations that can share knowledge and resources.
Kind of larger scale community education that can be integrated across all these different levels of education from elementary school all the way through college, multi-generational, you know, kids and parents and grandparents all kind of together in these various garden systems.
Green has been involved with many garden projects throughout Santa Barbara and says they provide valuable learning opportunities.
Children really love being out in the gardens. You could teach them all manner of ecology and science and math. And
Green helped start the garden programs on local elementary school campuses, which are now run by Explore Ecology. Explore Ecology took over the elementary outreach from City College in 2013. Lindsay Johnson is the executive director. She says Explore Ecology currently serves about 30 schools throughout Santa Barbara County.
Our team of garden educators maintains the gardens, keeps them thriving and beautiful, as well as works with students in the schools.
She says six schools near City College will directly participate in the grant. Explore Ecology site coordinator Marla Greer oversees the garden at Monroe Elementary School. Greer teaches students in grades K through 6. When not working the soil, she gathers with students in a shaded circle made of tree stumps. She talks with them about growing healthy food, water conservation, and much more.
This is more than a garden. This is an ecosystem. So there's lots of diversity. There's lots of habitats for different creatures, pollinators. There's lizards that we see very often. Birds come by and visit the garden.
The small plot includes fruit trees, flowers, and lots of vegetables. Greer says the young gardeners are especially interested in tasting what they grow. She says it's a place for kids to be curious and try new things, like figs and beets.
I think planting and tasting, if you were to ask a kid, is probably what they would say they enjoy the most.
Greer works closely with teachers to make connections between lessons in the classroom and lessons in the garden. Part of the plan, she says, is to involve the students' families, whether that means coming to the garden itself or sending home seeds and recipes. During the recent school closure due to the pandemic, Explore Ecology provided seed packs and a demonstration video so kids could plant at home. The grant is for 2 years, and the Santa Barbara City College Foundation must report back to the EPA. Rachel Johnson says she'll provide quarterly updates on activities.
We have a speaker series as part of this grant that is open to the public. And then there's also lots of activities that are happening on City College's campus and then also on the elementary school campuses.
The first public webinar was on monarchs and native pollinators. You can find it by going to exploreecology.org and click Get Involved. Look for the acronym SBEE, like the pollinators. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
This report is made possible by a grant from the Community Foundation, San Luis Obispo County. The Census Bureau estimates that just over 17% of U.S. adults aged 18 and older are unsure about or have already decided against receiving a COVID-19 vaccine. Experts say that level of vaccine hesitancy could make it difficult for the country to reach herd immunity. With that in mind, KCBX's Ben Perper spoke to local experts about vaccine hesitancy and how to talk to friends and family who are still undecided about the vaccine.
Jill Bolster-White is the executive director of Transitions Mental Health Association in San Luis Obispo. She says her teenage son and daughter just got the Pfizer vaccine, which has emergency approval for 12 to 15-year-olds.
For us, it was looking at sort of the risk analysis and what we thought were the unknowns about not being vaccinated and getting COVID and some of the concerns and unknowns that were connected there, but also the limitations that we think come along with not being vaccinated. And so the kinds of things that prevents them from being able to do, seeing family and friends who are older or who are in that health risk category, participating in events. I know schools are contemplating whether or not to require vaccines. Workplaces are having that same discussion. And so I think the preponderance of the evidence for us made it really make sense to have our whole family get vaccinated.
Bolster-White says Transition's role as a mental health provider means vaccines were a priority for her staff and clients.
People who have mental illness actually have a lower longevity. So they don't live as long. Generally, they have higher health issues, tend to be low income. So those were other reasons that we were wanting to make vaccines available for our clients and for staff.
Bolster-White says her biggest tip in convincing hesitant people to get the vaccine is by recommending they talk to their doctor if they have one.
My big tip is talk to your doctor, talk to your children's pediatrician, talk to your own primary care provider. They are the best people. They know you. They know the best advice. They have really looked at the science behind these vaccines. And so I think talking to your healthcare provider is probably the best way to get the information that you're and answer the questions that you might have.
Dr. Tamara Battle is a pediatrician and board chair of Sierra Vista Regional Medical Center. We should note that Tenet Health, which operates Sierra Vista, is a KCBX underwriter. Battle says the best way to talk to hesitant patients is by explaining the science.
I try to educate with information, with factual information, and this is a vaccine. It's an mRNA, messenger RNA vaccine. It doesn't stay within a system. The way that it functions is to help our body design a protein that can then recognize if COVID comes into our body. And then our body dispenses with that information, with the information to code the protein. So there's not anything that's lingering. This is not a live vaccine.
Battle says there are a few common myths that come up with hesitant patients, one being that vaccines cause infertility or negatively affect pregnant women.
The recommendation from the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology is to not withhold the COVID-19 vaccine from any pregnant or nursing mother.
Just like Bolster-White, Battle encourages anyone with questions or concerns about the vaccine to talk to their doctor.
And I encourage anyone who has questions to make an appointment with their pediatrician to voice what myths or what their friends or what they've seen on the internet, what data they've seen there versus what's factual, what are we seeing in person, and to have a more personalized answer to the concerns that they have.
Those who don't have access to healthcare services can get their questions answered at emergencyslow.org. As part of a local effort to address vaccine hesitancy, San Luis Obispo County started an effort to name members of the community as vaccine champions, people and organizations who spread the word about the benefits of getting vaccinated. Paul Worsham is the chairman of the San Luis Obispo Veteran Services Collaborative and a vaccine champion.
We started referring to this as the war at home, and that has been our approach to marshal all of our resources. And when you're in a war, it's all in or nothing. So that has been our approach to being a vaccine champion.
Part of being a vaccine champion, Worsham says, is convincing other veterans to get the vaccine through leading by example.
We felt a sense of duty to not only get vaccinated ourselves, but to encourage all of the veterans and their families, their dependents, to get vaccinated as well.
You can find more information about COVID-19 vaccines locally at slocounty.ca.gov. For KCBX News, I'm Benjamin Perper.
Up next on The Nonprofit Story, your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes, has a conversation with Gregory McGill, the founder of Honor Flight Central Coast of California. The organization takes veterans to Washington, D.C. to visit and reflect at the memorials which have been built to honor their service.
So, Greg, tell us a little bit about Honor Flight Central Coast California for those who haven't heard about it.
Yeah, so we're a 100% volunteer-based organization. We got our start here in the Central Coast, covering San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties back in 2014. And what we do is we take veterans who have served, and we start with our most senior veterans, World War II, Korean War veterans, and we work back from there. And those veterans who have served, many of them have never made it back to the nation's capital to see their memorials that were built in their honor. And quite honestly, we want to take as many veterans back as we can. And being a fully volunteer organization, every penny we raise, we can give right back to the veterans. To date, we've transported almost 350 veterans from the Central Coast of California back to D.C. And it's a three-day whirlwind tour. I mean, we leave out of San Luis Obispo Airport bright and early. We're back on the East Coast that evening, dinner, nice little banquet dinner. And then the next day, we're touring D.C., World War II Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, the Vietnam Wall, Korean War Memorial. We see all of the different memorials for the different branches of service, the Navy, Air Force. We go to Arlington to the Tomb of Unknown Soldiers for our Army guys. And then we go to, the next day, we go to Annapolis Naval Academy, usually. And then we go to Fort McHenry, and then we fly back, back on the West Coast 72 hours later.
That is a huge trip in a very short period of time. How are you able to put all of this together to make sure everyone is safe and comfortable?
So it's a huge team effort. This organization started in Ohio back in 2005. I learned about it in 2012, and we started flying veterans from the Central Coast in 2013. Mm-hmm. Since that time, we've put a board together. So there's a lot of logistics that go into it. And as far as the safety goes, we have people back there as well who are on team honor flight, so to say.
Okay.
And they provide us with all the wheelchairs. They provide us with the ice chest and all the water. In the warmer time of the year, we make sure there's electrolyte packets for everybody. We usually take a nurse on the trip to be evaluating people if somebody starts to have medical problems. And we also have a emergency plan in place to where we will actually take veterans to the hospital if needed. We've rarely had to do that. We're a huge organization on a national level, but locally, we just, you know, we work as a team and we get everything together and we take safety personnel for all that stuff.
That's amazing. That is amazing. So each person has a guardian that goes with them. Tell us about that role.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. The guardian is an individual who it could be family member, or we've actually taken guardians who are just, they don't know anybody, but they love the organization and they want to, that's how I got my start. I didn't know anybody on the trip, but they just go back to DC. They're assigned a veteran, and the guardians are really there to be the hands and everything for the veteran. They're going and getting their food for them, bringing it to them at the table. And I mean, nice banquet style dinners, breakfasts, pushing them in the wheelchair, carrying their luggage, getting them their coffee. Just there to make sure they're having a great time and they enjoy this trip. And like I tell our guardians, if you go selflessly and give 100% of your heart to that veteran, you're going to get more enjoyment out of that trip than if you went on the trip for yourself. You really will. These veterans, I built friendships with veterans just from going as their guardian. And, you know, it's a great experience. And you're literally taking that trip with living history.
That's amazing. You probably learn so much as you go on this too.
You get to hear this. You get to hear the stories that aren't in history books. Each man and woman's individual story from when they were in the military or in that wartime era.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Dr. Consuelo Mukes is having a conversation with Gregory McGill, the founder of Honor Flight Central Coast of California.
Wow. Now, so Greg, with that, will this have to be people who are in active service, or could they have been in reserves, or how does a person qualify?
So originally when this organization started, we were only doing wartime era veterans who'd served during World War II and Korea War veterans. But we're getting so many donations coming in now that we're able to fund not just us in particular, but nationally. We've changed our policy to anybody who'd served in the military. And then we just kind of lump them in by when they served. We take our World War II veterans first, and if they'd served in that era, and then maybe after that era, they're now lumped in with the Korean War veterans. So we just try and get our most senior veterans back to D.C. There used to be a statistic out there that our veterans were passing away, our senior veterans were passing away about 1,000 a day. And that number came down significantly. And the reason it's came down is just simply there's so few of them left. Wow. So we're really rushing against the clock to get as many veterans back to D.C. to see their memorials. You've always been a veteran. You served faithfully. And you have these memorials that are 3,000 miles away, and you never get to see them. We just don't feel like that's acceptable, so we make it happen.
What's the planning like? How do you get involved? First of all, let's say if you are a veteran or your family wants to get you involved, how can that happen?
So the easiest thing is I really encourage family to get involved because a lot of our veterans aren't as tech savvy. I mean, technology's came a long way since 1942, you know. And so I like to get veterans. I'll have their family get onto our webpage. It's Honor Flight CCC, and that stands for Central Coast of California. So honorflightccc.org. Okay. And right on there, there's an application tab, and that's a PDF fillable tab. You could fill out an application right there, submit it, and our secretary gets it, and we will log you and let you know we have your application. And it's the same thing for a guardian. Family members get first choice at being the guardian, but I always tell people if there's guardians out there veterans out there who don't have a guardian, we will find you a guardian and we'll find you a good guardian as well. Mm-hmm.
This is the Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes. I'm speaking with Gregory McGill. He is the founder of the Honor Flight Central Coast, California. So Gregory, on the guardians, I was reading that if you're a family member, you have to be at least 16 years old, or if non-family member, 18 years old, but maybe spouses don't get to go. So what are some of the parameters to be a guardian?
So that is correct. And typically I'll say we don't take spouses as guardians. And the reason being is generally we're taking anywhere from 90 to high 80s year old individual, whether it's man or woman. Mm-hmm. And we really need guardians who are able to walk several miles a day, who can push wheelchairs, who could carry luggage, who could help ice the ice chest. The guardians are honestly the worker bees of Honor Flight. Without the guardians, there would not be Honor Flight, because we take anywhere from 20 to 22 veterans per trip. Wow. And so that's 20 guardians, that's 20 wheelchairs, that's 20 duffel bags. I mean, it's 20 of everything. And then you times that by two with the guardians. So we have to have people who can carry their own weight. We do encourage family members. And like I said, if we don't have family members, we find people in this community who are chomping at the bit to go on one of these trips with a veteran.
So someone can volunteer to go and be on this 3-day trip. Yeah. How do people get ready? I hear that you have a luncheon to tell people about the plans, how to pack, how to get ready.
Yeah. So back to the guardians real quick. Guardians are self-funded as well, because like I said, all of our money is raised for veterans. That's 100% of our money for veterans. So I just want to be clear with that. And then for getting ready, we do have a luncheon prior to. We get all the veterans together. They get to meet each other. Some of them know each other, some from different veterans organizations, others first time meeting. But when you put them all in a room together, they all become instant friends. It's that bond 75 years later, that bond that they're just now getting after leaving the military. And we tell them what the trip's going to be like. We kind of give them an insight as to what to pack and how to pack, because we supply them with their t-shirts, we supply them with their duffel bags. We let them know about kind of the airport process and how things are going to go. And we just try and give them the heads up. And then we also do a little bit of a mandatory guardian training as well. There's little things you don't think about, setting the brakes on the wheelchairs, making sure, you know, taking the cane away from the veteran while they use the handrail to go upstairs. That way they're using a nice firm object as opposed to something I caught up on the stairs. So I've done 9 of these trips. I pride myself. I've never dropped a veteran. And, and when I'm giving the guardian training, I take that very serious. I let them know, hey, this is how we keep our veterans safe. And that's why we do the guardian training as well.
You know, you said something that really struck me. You said that some of these people, well, it's been 75 years since these people have maybe come together with another vet. I mean, this is really a wonderful thing for people who have for a long time ago served our country and now finally getting to honor them. I also read there some people might be terminally ill, but you will still allow that veteran to go.
Yeah, we've taken people who, I mean, have ALS or completely wheelchair bound. Lou Gehrig's disease, for those who don't know what ALS is, and completely wheelchair bound. And we have the motto, if you're willing to go, we'll make you able to go. We have aisle chairs for the airplanes. We have wheelchairs. We have buses with wheelchair lifts. We have guardians with those kind of people. We may encourage 2 family members to come on the trip to help get them in and out of bed. But we have one guy, Ken Palos. Ken was a son. Alex Palos was the veteran. And his son, Ken, told us, you know, I truly believe you bought my dad 6 more months of life. Because you could just see, even though he was completely wheelchair bound, you just see the joy this trip brought to him. And it was a great experience.
I believe your whole organization, you volunteer, is that correct? Or you have staff?
We have staff. We have a full board, a secretary, a treasurer, our chair, vice chair. We also have just a bunch of volunteers that help with putting on things such as like Vino for Veterans, which is one of our annual fundraisers we do. But at that level, there's still nobody who collects a paycheck. Most people in our organization are either retired or just looking for something to do to help out the community. And we have a great board. I can't say enough about the board members.
That's amazing. Here is an all-volunteer organization doing all of this work and giving every dime that comes in back to the veterans so that they can take the trip. So if somebody wants to travel here in San Luis Obispo, can they leave from anywhere they want to and meet you there, or do they have to come to San Luis?
So we encourage people like the guardians to start with the veteran on the trip. All of our veterans take off with us out of here. The good thing about Honor Flight is there's over 130 chapters nationwide. So if there's someone who may live in Southern California, there's an Honor Flight chapter down there. If they may live, I mean, there's just chapters all over. And we actually work with other chapters as well when it comes to layovers at the airports and that kind of stuff. So we like to help each other out. And one thing we'll do by helping each other out is calling them and letting them know, hey, you have a veteran in your area who's wanting to go, and when he lives here, please reach out to him.
So if somebody is coming in and say you're going to be leaving, maybe they're coming in from out of the area. What happens if they come in an evening and you leave in the morning? Do you help them to have an accommodation, like a room or something?
So we do have hotels that we work with, and we've had veterans come in who may live several hours away. And we'll put them up in the hotel. And the way we look at that is that's part of the trip. And we go ahead and cover the bill for that veteran and put them up in a room.
That's fabulous. So they double bunked with someone, or they bunk with their family, or
typically we bunk them with their guardian. And that way the guardian is there with the veteran 24/7. Our priority number one is safety for the veteran. And then priority number two is just to make sure that veteran has the best experience they can. And that's why we really put the guardians with the veteran, is to make sure they're being watched after 24/7. And two, that guardian could help them with whatever they need in the morning, whether it's going down and getting them a cup of coffee while they get ready, those kind of things.
So now you are a 501c3. Is it all right if people want to donate to you?
Absolutely. We don't turn down donations, because we know exactly where the money's going and we know how we're going to use it. And like I like to tell people, I've had people say, well, I could only donate $10. Well, $10 could buy a lunch for one of these veterans. Mm-hmm. So I don't look at it in pennies and dollars. I look at it as in, what can I do with that money? How many hotel rooms can I get? How many airline tickets can I purchase? That's how we really look at the money when it comes in.
So I guess people can go to the website and find a way to donate.
You could donate online, or just reach out to us through email like you did, and we will gladly help you make a donation. Our treasurer is on it, and she will have you a tax ID letter within a week.
Wonderful. We're almost out of time, Greg, but is there a story that was really important to you, or something that you can share about a trip?
I've been doing this for years now, and I have plenty of stories, but one I'll say is we had one career guy who was an Air Force veteran and one career guy who was a Marine Corps veteran, and they were sat next to each other on the plane. They both did 20 years in the military, and these guys started talking about where they'd spent their military time, different bases in Germany, stateside, and they started realizing that they were at the same bases during the same time frame. They knew where all the same bars were. They knew everything. They knew the barracks, all this stuff.
Wow.
And they'd never met each other. And it wasn't until 45 years later, because these guys were career men, that they meet each other and were able, and they hit it off. And they were able to just have a great conversation the whole flight back.
So if people want to know more about the Honor Flight Central Coast, California, it's at honorflightccc.org. And donations are very, very welcome. And everything goes to the veterans with this fully volunteer organization. I've been speaking with Gregory McGill, the founder of the Honor Flight Central Coast, California. Gregory, thank you for being with us today on The Nonprofit Story.
Thank you. Have a good day.
This is Consuelo Mukes. Thanks for joining us.
And finally, Working Lunch, a Facebook Live program where the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's president, Jim D'Antona, speaks with a community leader.
Welcome to Working Lunch. Today, we'll be having a conversation with Wendy Lewis, president and CEO of the El Camino Homeless Organization, often referred to as ECHO. Before joining ECHO in 2018, Wendy worked at the Food Bank Coalition and was instrumental in increasing access to nutritious food to people facing hunger in Slo County. Wendy, thank you so much for being here today.
I'm so excited, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Fabulous to have you. And as we sit down to lunch here, where are you zooming in from?
I'm zooming in from Atascadero, from our original location, kind of our flagship that kicked off over these 20 years of our work in the community.
Did 8-year-old Wendy think you wanted to be a CEO of a nonprofit when you grew up? What was that like?
I think 8-year-old Wendy wanted to actually be a teacher. And I moved up to go to Cal Poly, and it didn't end up going in the teaching realm. And I actually was in sales for many years. And while my kids were little, and I could work around the schedule and be there for them. And then I just got tired of selling and just for a profit. So I wanted to take that energy and actually bring my sales experience and sell a really great cause. And that's when I transitioned to the food bank. And then I just continued that once I got into nonprofits. It's addictive, you know, being able to have your work really impact lives. It's the most special thing that I just love it.
Was there a particular event or influence that led you to do the work you're doing today?
You know, I think it was just kind of one of those moments in life where you go, gosh, there's a lot of need in the community. And can I take my skills and can I really be part of making a positive change in my own community? It wasn't, you know, it was just kind of that like moment you feel and you're like, I'm going to explore something different. And I'm so excited. It's been about 14 years I've been in the nonprofit world, and just so grateful to have been part of people's journey, even at the food bank, working on food insecurity. And then here at ECHO, I cannot tell you how special it is to be part of someone's journey as they get back into housing. That moment that, you know, someone comes and says, oh my gosh, I just signed my lease, or my children and family are now going to have a place. I mean, that just makes, you know, it makes it all worth it.
Was ECHO a partner of the Slo County Food Bank?
Yeah, it's actually, ECHO is about a minute away from my house. So in some of my roles at the food bank, I actually would do the agency partner check-ins here at ECHO. And it's amazing to see what it was, you know, that was, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago to what we are now. It's been really exciting to see. But I love how through that collaboration and through such great nonprofits in our county, we are able to bring the right resources. And, you know, the food bank is just an amazing partner, and we get a lot done through collaboration. And that's just one of those great partnerships.
Before we dive into the specifics of your work, maybe you could share a little information and maybe set the stage of the situation people experiencing homeless face in North County today.
ECHO's been around 20 years, and you know, the face of who we served 20 years ago is quite different than who we serve now. It was more the chronic male back then, and now it's men, women, and children, seniors. And in North County in particular, it's tough. I mean, if you are unhoused and you are heading into summer, and you know, there's going to be days that it's 115, you know, you have no place to get just the safety of being in an air conditioning. And in the winter, it is really cold. You know, and some nights we get into the 15s, the 20s. And so, you know, that just imagining not being able to be in a safe, warm place, it's really challenging. There's some lack of resources in North County. So that's part of some of our growth and what we've been working on. But, you know, just it, the face of who you might imagine, it's different. And it's a tough road for sure.
You know, our senior population growing more and more into that homeless as, you know, either living longer, not having enough resources, keep up with the housing costs.
That's one of the populations that's really is dramatically growing, and there just isn't enough resources. So as a community, we need to really look at that changing face of homelessness and that aging population.
Well, we have a number of nonprofit and government agencies that serve unhoused people in Slo County. Where does ECHO and the work you do fit into that ecosystem?
Again, collaboration gets things done, and we have a great partnership with our friends at CAPSLO and 40 Prado and Five Cities Homeless Coalition. We really look at the county and kind of what we can bring to our regions and what resources and things that we might specialize in, and really try to look at that collaboratively. So we're not duplicating services. We're being really efficient with the funding that's coming in through the government streams into our county. And so we actually jointly write many grants together. So that way we are able to really look at the big picture and then bring those resources to our region. Depending on someone's needs, we work together. We have a lot of specialize in a lot of family programming. And so a lot of times if there's someone who has children, they're connected to us. And we just really work closely to make sure we're all able to serve the community that needs us.
Are there one or two programs that you're particularly proud of?
Gosh, that's that. Yeah, pick your favorite child for sure. So we really strive to provide the support to everybody, but especially families with children, children who are facing homelessness. You know, there's that trauma that's experienced. So we really try to provide anything we can to prevent that trauma while they're with us and get them back into housing. So we have things like a reading program where volunteers from the community come and sit next to our garden, you know, throw a blanket down in the good weather, and they really interact with the children. That's a partnership with the Community Foundation and the Raising the Reader program. And it's amazing to see how the kids just light up, but then parents who might not have had a lot of experience on how to read to your children and interact, they get to see that and gain that knowledge. So that's one. The children's art program, I mean, the art they create is amazing. But yeah, I could keep going on and on. We really, really provide a lot of programming and resources for everybody we serve.
Childhood is hard enough without being unhoused. But what are some of the biggest misunderstandings about the work you do, you know, maybe from the general public?
Yeah, you know, when I first got into homeless services, it was hard in some ways, because you would hear conversations or hear things from people from a place where a lack of understanding or knowledge base, and, you know, the generalization of the population, things like, you know, people are choosing this life, they're choosing not to work, it's their own fault. And when you really dive into homelessness, there's so many different layers of why people become unhoused, what resources they need to get back into housing. So it was really that dehumanization that was really tough. But we're really trying to get out there and show people that These are your neighbors. Many folks are from Slo County that we see. It isn't this wave of people moving in. The last point in time count, 74% of the people counted in our county as unhoused were born and raised here. So these are your neighbors. These are someone you went to school with. It really is, as a community, something we need to provide the right tools to get them back into housing.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. The Slo Chamber's Jim D'Antona is having a conversation with Wendy Lewis of the El Camino Homeless Coalition.
You were extremely successful in working with the community to help house more people over the past year. Were there any key strategies for overcoming that opposition and creating understanding with that?
Yeah, so our biggest, you talked a little bit about our growth over the past year and the facilities we have. One of the facilities, we actually took on an emergency winter shelter. So that is one of the three. And then we had an incredible collaboration with People's Self-Help Housing and Haslo to really utilize HomeKey funding that was coming through the state. Really a gift of potential, almost, I don't want to say instant, but it felt like instant housing and shelters. And that was to purchase motels or existing buildings and convert over to supportive housing and shelters. So this project has been incredible and really making an impact in our community and especially in Paso Robles.
In trying to do that, were there big barriers there that you had to work and maybe break down some of these misunderstandings in order to get it open?
Yeah, well, the speed of it was definitely a barrier. It was when the county contacted ECHO originally to say, hey, we're hearing about this funding. We're hearing that potentially Motel 6 in Paso Robles is going to sell. Is it something ECHO can look at? And as an organization that's been around 20 years, we want to make sure we do things the right way. And so I drove through that project and I realized the scope of the hotel, 122 rooms. I said, we can't do this alone, and reached out to our friends at People Self-Help Housing. And, you know, none of us needed more work to do, but it was the right thing to do. It was such a potential gift. And then as we determined, oh, we're going to need another partner, you know, reached out to our partners at Haslo, and same thing. I mean, they were like, oh, we don't need more work, but we need housing. And we convinced boards before even board meetings. And, you know, it's just incredible. So we've been up and running about 6 months, and the amount of impact it's having and people getting services and getting housed, it's just an incredible project.
Can you give us just a couple quick stats on that facility?
We have 42 rooms that are used for emergency sheltering, and they have 60 plus units of low-income supportive housing. And so we're able to really provide that really first step into someone connecting and getting resources. Keep in mind, Paso Robles didn't have any homeless services until this project came in. They had a wonderful meal program that was offered, but past that, there really wasn't anything. So no connecting people to mental health support, behavioral health, case management, none of that really was happening. So we're bringing in that piece and really getting people that first step. You know, here's a safety, here's a place to be. Now let's have conversations about what you need, what we can help with, and let's get you housed. And on the permanent housing side, they have, you know, that permanent home. And so people come into our program, we get them kind of ready for what we do, then we get them ready for long-term housing. And we've already, in 6 months, 20 people through our work have been housed in the community. So one of the big impacts is really getting people housed.
As you said, this is about 120 room facility. So is there that unique opportunity that comes with this shelter to be able to transition folks right away?
Well, actually, the HomeKey funding, which was state funding that was set aside to really create housing fast with the housing first model. So the funding really says, this is the model that's working throughout our state. Are you going to commit to do this and want to do it right? And we, in our services, saw that as a lack in our community of that, really that housing first for the shelter piece, especially in North County. And it really is getting someone that first access, first time they might have taken a warm shower for a long time, first time someone has just actually had a conversation in an empowerment way, and we care about you, we know living on the streets is not easy. Let's find solutions. So really it's meeting them where they're at. They might be struggling with behavioral health, drug and alcohol. They might be struggling with mental health. And we give them that first place to start getting access to those services.
We were looking at the governor's recently announced budget. He talked about $12 billion, of which was like about $8 billion for new housing projects. So are more projects like this one on the horizon for SLO County?
Well, with the last point in time count, there was about 1,500 people who were counted that were unhoused in our county. Those of us in homeless services kind of say for every one you counted, there's probably two. So imagine there's about 3,000 people. That was in 2019. So are there needs for more of these projects? Yes. Between us and the other shelters in our county, we probably have about 400 shelter beds, including the domestic violence houses. And so there's that gap, you know, that's a gap of about 900. Housing is needed. Housing quickly is needed, and that wraparound services to go with them and support them when they are housed.
And thinking about some of those dollars that the governor's committing to, and thinking about how you brought your staff up to deal with a home key and really meet the challenge, how do you balance the temptation to take in those monies right now? Because these seem like one-time funds. They're not ones that are going to fund ongoing programs. Is that right?
Yeah, you kind of called out one of the challenges, probably the biggest challenges. You know, the original gift it was about a $15 million grant for the project to purchase the building to bring in programming, but the grant only lasts for about a year and a half. So we as an organization have to look at sustainability and how do we keep this programming happening. And so that's, you know, to convince your board to say, hey, we're just going to take on another shelter, probably double or triple our budget, and we'll figure out how to sustain it. You know, our board was, you know, just incredible people who trusted our organization, knew we could do it, knew the community would step up when we said, you know, okay, now we need the community support to really keep this going. But it's a leap of faith. And so with this new funding coming, you know, are there going to be more leaps of faith? You know, we'll have to see how that all plays out. I use a baseball analogy, of course. I say if you build it, the funding will come if you're doing the right work and making impact and changing lives. So, yeah, if you build it, you know, those great people in the community that want to help someone get back into housing, they'll come. And, you know, we're very faithful for that.
What are some of the things you are hopeful for besides more funding that will have sustained your leap of faith?
That's probably the top priority. Also, just I'm hopeful for the community to be open to more education, be open to know that these are really members of our community that need the support. Just hopeful to see more journeys of people. And sometimes homelessness feels hopeless. And I just want to share, there's hope. We talk about numbers, but every number is a family or a human. We need to celebrate their success because they've done the work. Yeah, there's hope in this work.
Is there one in particular you'd be open to sharing?
So I think one of the ones that stands out with me the most, and we always ask for permission to share someone's story, and the people we serve are always so willing because they know if we can share, people can be successful, that helps us. And so there is this wonderful young lady named Bethany, and her two sweet children came to us first pretty early on when I got here to Echo. And, you know, she just was ready. She admits that there was some bumps in her life and she needed to make some major changes. And for her children, she just told us, hey, I'm ready. I'm ready to do whatever I need to do. So we were able to connect her to some support systems to help her with some changes that she needed to make. We were able to help the kids get into a preschool so Bethany could work. And then through just hard work, financial savings, financial literacy, she was housed right before Christmas a few years ago. And I actually got to be there. I usually am not in those moments. And I got to be there when her daughter opened the door and grabbed my hand and said, you got to see my room, and ran me into her room. And so, you know, I check in, you know, Bethany and her children are doing well. The kids are thriving. Her personal growth is just amazing to see. And now this family has the security they need.
Those success stories must just really help you go on to the next challenge. Do you have any recommendations for people who want to get involved and make a difference for people experiencing homelessness in our community?
We really couldn't do our work without the community volunteerism. We have about 500 volunteer slots we fill at both locations each month in order to do our work. And so volunteering, I can tell you, you'll get way more out of it. You're giving a service, but what you learn and what you get to see is so impactful. Advocating for the people we serve and people in our community that are unhoused, helping through financial donations if you have the means to do so, that really helps us look at sustainability and really bring in that extra layer of programming and empowerment, and just really being aware and kind of recognizing that the unhoused are people. You know, if that's somebody, it's easy to put them into a group and hopefully not have to really, really look. We had a gentleman who shared with one of our outreach workers that until he came to Echo, he didn't feel visible. And we don't want people in our community to feel that way.
Wendy, thank you so much for talking with us about this incredibly important issue. And thank you to your entire team for the work you're doing.
That was the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona speaking with Wendy Lewis of the El Camino Homeless Coalition, known as ECHO. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.